Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
We're presented by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app today and use code DAN for a special offer when you sign up. That's code DAN, only at DraftKings Sportsbook.
Hello, welcome to another South Beach Sessions. I am Dan Le Batard, and the Hall of Famer, Jason Taylor, is someone I've enjoyed talking to for a long time. He is unusually candid and honest about a whole lot of things. I think candid and honest are synonyms. Regardless, he's both those things. Honest doubled. And the most insightful article I've ever written about NFL pain was with Jason Taylor. I suggest that you look that up, because you will learn about what it takes, the kind of crazy it requires to be great and excellent at that sport. Great and excellent, also synonyms, but that is how I double up his excellence. The Hall of Famer, Jason Taylor, here he is. Jason, was there anything about getting into the Hall of Fame that caught you totally off guard? Any of the emotions, any of the nostalgia, any of the mortality, any of it?
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of things that catch you off guard. I mean, you have a body of work that you feel like stacks up, but you really lose control once you retire and you wait those 5 years, you lose control. And it's weird because, you know, if you're a Peyton Manning or a Tom Brady, you know, one of those kind of guys, your body of work speaks for itself forever, for eternity. But you feel like sometimes in the positions where there's not as much limelight or people don't know as much about you or you're not always out there, you're not a quarterback, a receiver, a running back, those 5 years, you know, your body of work kind of ages, and not in a good way, like a cigar or wine. It just kind of ages and you get further and further away from the game, and people may forget about the impact or the game changing plays or the splash plays that you made, because there's so much more football that happens in those 5 years. So, you know, the initial knock on the door was, you know, I was taken aback. You know, I thought in the back of my mind I was a Hall of Famer. I just didn't know if it was going to be a first ballot, if it was going to be years later. So that was the biggest surprise at the beginning. And then the way people look at you, and, you know, having that HOF associated with your name, it kind of changes the attitude when you walk in the door. It changes the aura when you walk into an appearance or a function. It's just different. And then, you get up there and you get around. At the time, I was 308. And you sit back and you think, like, and there's been thousands and tens of thousands of players that have played this game, and, you know, you're one of 300 and some people that they decided to put in. It's pretty humbling.
Can you explain, you've always been great at explaining this to the audience, what it took physically, mentally, spiritually, willfully for you to be excellent?
Wow, I mean, it took everything. It takes years off your life, I think. It takes physical functionality as you get older away from you. It takes sacrifice. It takes some insanity. It takes to be a little, you know, we're a little touched. We're a little thrown off in certain ways. And we do things that aren't healthy, in some ways probably aren't legal, so to speak, aren't, you know, they're not encouraged from medical professionals, from normal people. When I say normal, you know, we're all normal, but we do things that are, we're normal people with extraordinary jobs, and we have kind of a weird way of looking at things, most of us. And I think if you take the great ones, that they all have that piece. And there's plenty of guys that come in this league that are happy to be there. They're there for a cup of coffee, or they're there for whatever their motivation is. But to really go out and be the best, you got to sacrifice a lot. You have to do a lot. And it's, you know, we all hear about the TB12 process and the things that he does, totally different than what I saw the majority of my career with the guy that I played with, the great players that I played with, or even myself. I mean, I being in a hospital for Thursday through Saturday, checking out Sunday morning and going to the stadium to play a game, and then checking yourself back in Sunday night, it's just stupid.
Well, this is interesting because when I talked to you about it once upon a time, because of what it is, the body would hurt more now. When you say years off your life, I know with kids and love and everything else that you have in your life, now your perspective might be different. But back then you were like, I'd do it all over again, every time, all over again, because I'm a little off and because this thing, there's nothing like it for your identity, for your ego, for your adrenaline, for living a life on a higher plane than the rest of us.
Yeah. And if you ask the question, would I go back and do it again? Right now. You know, give me 5 minutes to change and I'll be out in the practice field. It's just, I loved every bit of it. I loved every moment of it. But the problem is when you're in it and you're always chasing a championship. And I tell a lot of young kids this now, that, you know, as I'm coaching and people, when I talk to them, they talk about football. I was always so focused on that destination of winning a championship, winning a Super Bowl, and then looking forward to the repeat process of trying to get prepared for another one. And I never got there. So when I left the game, the finality of leaving the game, I felt unfulfilled in some ways. I felt like a failure in some ways. Like I let down a lot of people in some ways. And I know it's not an individual game, but that's just the feelings you take away from the game when you're so singularly focused on winning a championship. And I didn't enjoy the journey and the process. So if I went back now, which I would do in a heartbeat, listen, I can't run from here to my car, but if I had the opportunity to play, I would do everything I could to get back out there. But if I had the chance to do it again, I would enjoy the process. I would enjoy the moments that I hated. You know, sometimes you bitch and you moan about those West Coast trips on a primetime game in the West Coast, and you're flying back and you land back in Miami when the sun's coming up, and you know, after a Monday night game and you're already eating into your day off and having to go back Wednesday. You know, you bitch about the training camp days. You bitch and moan about the two-a-days back when they had two-a-days with Jimmy Johnson when I wanted to quit. And I thought I couldn't do it anymore. I physically thought I couldn't get out of bed anymore. And, you know, the injury times, or you know, having to get shot up in the belly of in Death Valley. We played at Tiger Stadium against the New Orleans Saints after the hurricane. You know, those moments where you just, you're like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? And you get pissed off because you don't win. I need to go back and enjoy those times, those plane trips with the teammates, those hard times, those fun times, shit talking.
You can't enjoy the dungeon where you were getting those shots in your foot, this dank cell of horrible foot pain. That you can't go back and enjoy the physical pain that makes you. I think you told us the story. They had to put a towel in your mouth for the shot, the first shot that was just preparing you for the second shot.
I know in a strange way, it sounds like you can't enjoy that, but I would do it again. Like I just wish I can go do it one more time. You know, put it that way. I wish I can just go do it one more time. And yeah, that was hell. You know, I think I've told you, were the first person, probably the only person I told this story to on air. You know, just doing things, taking your body places where it really shouldn't go, in a game where I probably shouldn't be playing. And there's probably no probably about it. I shouldn't be playing, and some guys wouldn't. And that was just my mentality. Is I always wanted to be on the field. It wasn't about the pay. You know, you're getting paid to do this. I don't give a shit about that. That's a byproduct of what we get a chance to do. I wanted to be out there. I loved game day. You only get 16, well, now 17. You used to only get 16 of them. 16 days out of the year to be great. That's all you need. The rest of the time you could be, you can do whatever and get through practice or miss practice. And then this whole, what do they call it now? This in this new age, load maintenance or whatever. Fucking load maintenance. We didn't have that shit. Like, you know, but 16 days out of a calendar year, I need to go be great. And I'll do whatever I can to get to that dirt at 1 o'clock or whatever time we kick it off. So being down now, first of all, you know, my son signed with LSU. So I had a chance to go back there a few times. I was in the stadium on the home side. The home side is so much nicer than the visitor side, obviously in every stadium, but whatever that room was that I went in, it had a concrete floor. It had concrete overhead, 'cause I think it was part of the bleachers. But the concrete bleachers did not meet the concrete on the floor. So what would be the wall, I think, was like dirt that was like chipping off. And it was musty. It's like an old, like growing up in Pittsburgh, it's like that old basement that's just musty and always has a little bit of moisture to it. And who knows what lived in there before you turned the lights on. That's where I went to get this shot. And you know, we've all been the doctors, dentists, everywhere. You know, when you know, I'm scared of needles, but it sounds crazy because I've taken way too many shots in my life. You know, you ask a doctor, hey, is this going to hurt? And most doctors do what? They lie to you and say, oh, no, it'll just be a little pinch. So I asked the doctor, I won't name his name, but I asked the doctor, hey, is this going to hurt? And he's like, yeah, I'm not going to bullshit you. This is going to be the worst pain you've ever felt. So Tony Egwes went and got me a Gatorade towel. I rolled it up, folded it in half, and put it in my mouth. And it was by far the worst pain I've ever had.
I've said to people when we have a mental health conversation around football, I've said what those people, and you say we're a little off, what those people have to do for a living would test the mental health of anyone who has ever lived.
Yes. Yeah, it would. You know, it's part of the game, but I think it's also individual. It's how far are you willing to push? And some guys, you know, some guys opt out for the COVID year. Some guys opt out of bowl games to avoid injury. And I get that. It's different scenarios for everybody. Some guys get hangnails and don't want to play. You know, I was 1-15 with Cam Cameron. I probably shouldn't have said that. I'm probably going to shit myself now thinking about it again. But, you know, guys were checking out for everything, you know, but how far are you willing to push yourself? And if you're comfortable, you're not in the right place, because you have to learn how to play with pain. You have to learn how to play hurt. Injuries are different. They always try to differentiate being hurt from being injured as two different things. Yes, I get that. To me, it was, okay, I'm hurt or injured. What can I do to get back onto the field? Well, we can do this, this, and this. You're going to be at 70%. I'm like, well, shit, me at 70% is better than whoever's behind me at 100%. That was just my mindset. So it's not healthy. And I think you really need to have people around you that can tell you the truth sometimes, tell you what you don't want to hear sometimes, give you all the options, and then it's up to you to understand that you have to deal with this down the road.
The man sitting in front of me now, life experience, wisdoms accrued through toughness and lessons, would go back and advise you to do what differently at 20, 21, 22 years old?
Boy, there's so much. And again, I know it sounds simple. I don't want to repeat what I said earlier, but just enjoy it. Just enjoy the process. Enjoy the small times. Enjoy the times where nobody's around, which were enjoyable. You know, the nights in there where you're the last one in the building, or when you're in there, on a Sunday night after a game because you needed to work on something that you felt like you were deficient on during those 3 hours early in the day. Those times were fine, and I enjoyed that chase. But the smaller times, the lessons of losing, the thrills of winning, the thrill of winning a defensive player of the year, the thrill of being NFL man of the year. Those times are good. But they were, to me, at the time, in that moment, they were incomplete because I didn't win a championship. We weren't in the playoffs. You know, I won Defensive Player of the Year, but I was sitting at home getting fat, drinking and smoking cigars and playing golf. Like, I should still be playing in January. That's the reason we do all this shit, is to play in January, and we weren't doing it. So I would say that, because you can go 15 years. I remember I came in the league and Dan played whatever, 17, 18 years. Marino didn't win the championship, had been to one Super Bowl. And I'm like, there's no way. So I'm like, how can you go through 17 years in the league and not ever get to a Super Bowl? Like, it's just math. You feel like the odds, because the NFL is so built for parity. Like, our times has to come around at some point, and I hope I can play long enough. And then you get in the end and you played 15 years, and you're like, shit, I couldn't sniff the Super Bowl except for 1 year when I was in New York. We made the AFC Championship game. And it's just, you got to enjoy the moment. It's just like life and anything. Enjoy every moment of life, because it's so short, and we learn more and more as we get older, and having gone through, you know, the pandemic now and all the things we see, like, you just got to enjoy it while you have it, because it's going to be gone. And then you look back and like, damn, I wish I had one more beer on the plane, or wish I stood up and air surfed one more time during takeoff, and put my $20 bet in on that, you know, just the little stupid stuff.
What is that? Take me there. What was happening on the flight?
I shouldn't have said that.
What was the bad? You knew I was going to ask the follow up. You went to because you're doing a little of the mortality thing. I get this, right? Because the Fountain of Youth can be a little bit of the Hall of Fame could be a Fountain of Youth, where you get back and you're like, oh man, that was so cool. All the things that I did. You get nostalgic. You start looking back, looking ahead at your career mortality, looking at all of it. I can imagine that you look back with some fondness, some nostalgia, but also some sadness, because holy shit, did you have a good career?
I was blessed. And I had a good career. I made some plays, and I had some really good guys around me. And that's the thing. Like, I was just listening to a podcast not long ago, actually a few days ago, while I was working here in the warehouse with Larry Chester. And, you know, I forget about a guy like Larry Chester. He was so freaking crazy. Like Larry Chester and Tim Bowens and Daryl Gardner's big ass and Trace Armstrong and Derek Rogers and Zach and Sam and Pat and Brock, man, like all these guys. I'm like, man, we had some great times. And I get around Sam, you know, I had a chance to coach a year with Sam, or 2 years. I get around Sam, and we still laugh and crack about, you know, what happened. And, you know, Pat Surtain, and I see him all the time and tell stories. It's just, man, that's what those guys, and I know it sounds so cliche and all, he's trying to be humble. No, those guys are why I was good. Fuck, if you had Sam and Pat playing press man on the outside back in the day where they didn't throw a flag when you were at 4.5 yards and touching the receiver, those guys used to just kill people all over the field and give you forever to get there. Like it was almost easy once you got to the point where your mental part of your game matched your physical. So I give a lot of credit to those guys, and that's what you miss the most, man. It's being around those guys. You know, it's funny. I forget who I was talking to. Maybe it was Pat not long ago. I was talking to somebody, and it's like the little stupid shit that happens. You know, so on Saturday mornings before you leave for a road game, you know, you go in the facility, you do a walkthrough at 10 a.m., then the plane's leaving at 2. So you got to drive to the airport, meet him at the airport at 1:30 for check-in. So, you know, he's grown-ass men. And it's the same thing for a home game. You know, you go home and get ready. Grown-ass men, you're in your closet, you know, and you see guys that get all G'd up and wear suits and, you know, 19-piece suits and all this shit and ascots or whatever those things are called, all this stuff. You're in your closet at home worried about what somebody else on the plane is going to say about your outfit, because you used to have this the walk of death, and you had to walk in the front of the airplane and walk all the way to your back, seat in the back, and everybody would crack on you no matter what you did. Like times like that, like we were joking about it. You know, I'd go out and spend $4,000 on a suit and then be worried about what the fuck I'm putting on to get on the plane. You know, part of you says like, who cares what they think? But you had to hear it the whole time. So it was just, you know, those times are amazing.
What are the roots of your tough?
I think growing up in Pittsburgh, not having a father, not knowing who my dad was, and seeing different, I would say, role models, mentors, and mistakes, to kind of shape that path to keep you out of trouble and on, but still on edge. You know, it was never easy, but, you know, seeing guys struggle and fail, seeing guys make mistakes and go to jail, seeing guys get shot in front of me, you know, it's just those kind of things harden you in some ways. They kind of put a little callus on you. But then, you know, watching my mother struggle and being from a very blue collar area and we didn't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out of, you just freaking grind. And you get used to walking home in the cold. You get used to walking up the hill from school in the snow and in third grade. You get used to doing it, you know, and having to, I don't want to say fight to survive, because there's guys that had it worse, but shit wasn't easy. And one thing I always was competitive as hell. Now, I sucked early on. I couldn't win a fight to save my life till I think I was in fourth or fifth grade, you know, getting my ass whooped. But, you know, you whoop my ass, I'm going to try to find you the next day, because that competitive juice, but I had to get some get back. And then I'd find you the next day and I'd get my ass whooped again. I would go home and think about it, come back the next day and be like, I probably shouldn't fight you, but let's try this one more time. You know, and that happened until I finally won a fight in fifth grade. And then, you know, it's just, you're just fighting to survive. You're just fighting to get out of where you are, because you know there's something else out there. I was a big Steeler fan. I want to be a Pittsburgh Steeler. I want to be, you know, Michael Jordan in the Chicago Bulls, because Pittsburgh didn't have a basketball team. But how do I do that? I didn't have direction, but I always had to drive. I always had to fight and to drive, because I was always a small kid. I was a runt and kind of a dork, and nobody didn't have a whole lot of friends and all that shit, but it's fine.
Is that why you were getting beat up?
I was getting beat up because I was a I was just not very strong and didn't know how to fight. But I had the mentality where I wasn't going to take anything off of anybody, but I just wasn't there yet. I was just small. So my sister used to fight for me all the time, my older sister. And again, so I think I was in fifth grade. I won a fight against, I hate to put it out there, Charlie, but Charlie Batch was the first person I beat in a fight. We went to the same elementary school, and I don't even know what we were fighting about, because we were really good friends. And that was, I forget the name. I used to know everything, like the name of the two cross streets, like, because it was a moment in my life. Like this was it. I'm arriving. But we got in a fight there on a street corner, and I think I pushed him in the bushes, and as he got up, I was like, oh shit, I have to throw these hands. And he came at me and threw a few hands, and And I don't know if I, for the sake of the story, I dropped him, and that was my first win.
My team is one win away, and I'll tell you exactly what I'm going to do to celebrate once they get past this series. I'm going to go to my fridge, and I'm going to get myself an ice-cold can of Miller Lite. A lot's changed over the years, but one thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and it still hasn't been settled. You see, Miller Lite keeps it simple. Undebatable quality, great taste, and only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything that you don't need and holds on to what matters most. A light beer that tastes like beer, less filling and only 96 calories. The original light beer since 1975. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right at your door, visit MillerLite.com/beach, B-E-A-C-H. Or you can get it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Pain threshold. Can you explain to me where and how that came to be? Because I would imagine that you can endure a great, great deal more pain than I can.
You know, I don't know where it came from. It's always, I guess it's been there. And I guess when you get your ass beat enough, you learn how to live with pain. You learn how to deal with pain and try to overcome that adversity. But, you know, I've just always had a high threshold for it. You know, I hate missing anything. I'm I've never been diagnosed, but I think I'm a very OCD in some way, ADD kind of guy, or, you know, kind of guy that just always has to have something and want to keep going. I don't want to be out with a sickness. I don't want to be out with COVID. I don't want to be out with a flu. I don't want to be out with sniffles or anything or an injury. So I was always that way. I always pushed my body past where it needed to be. And there was instances that growing up that, you know, I was put in some very, you know, adverse situations that you are literally fighting to survive. And, you know, in those hardships, your body and your mind get you through those things. So it was easy when I got to football, you know, when I got to playing football and, you know, you have a knee injury, you have a messed up shoulder or whatever it may be. It was easier for me to tap back into. I know I can take my body further than anybody else that I'm looking at or most of the guys that I'm playing against. And I always took great pride in showing up.
You always, I don't know, whenever we have these longer conversations, you always end up going, visiting that dark space in your childhood and then stopping short of actually going to the details that would inform how you became who you became. There's something there. I don't mean to press you, but it seems like you always get to the doorstep of that and then turn around and don't actually open the door to anybody on what you saw that was so terrible that made you push yourself this way and imprinted you in an identity shaping way, right? Like, because this is a part of who you are and you're a bit proud of being able to overcome the shit you overcame.
Yeah.
We can do it again if you want. I don't want to push you into a place that you don't want to go, but it just seems like every once in a while you want to open that door and you put your hand on the doorknob and then you walk away. Almost every time we do this exploration of, because you're crazy. The things you've done, Jason, you talk about them matter-of-factly. I think the catheter is the craziest thing you've done. The catheter, yeah. Playing with a catheter and it, when doctors are saying you shouldn't have done that and you were exposed. But everyone in that sport is a little bit different, but you're Hall of Fame kind of different.
I'll be as candid as I can. You know, you're right about getting to that point and turning away from it, and I do that. I've done it with you before, and I do it with very few people. Is, you know, you're one of those guys that try to peel back layers, and you have a very unique way of making somebody comfortable and walking them to that point where they'll peel back layers. And I appreciate that. And that's what part of the reason why I love every time we talk. It took a long time for me to get past some of those things, some of those scars that I had from past instances. And part of those, some of those things make you great. Some of those things take you beyond where you should, make you tougher, grittier, nastier. And I tell people now, tell kids nowadays when I deal with them, sometimes the things that make you great in sports may be bad in life, or maybe made me very difficult to deal with at times in life, because you can't, not everything translates across, outside of those white lines. You know, the insanity, the craziness, the drive, the competitiveness, that nastiness, that chip on your shoulder nastiness doesn't always work in life. Whether it be a marriage, whether it be in fatherhood, whether it be in friendships, or just dealing with somebody in traffic or somebody at the gas station or that cuts you off, whatever. So, you know, I've done a lot of work and tried to do a lot of healing and growing from some of those dark things that I've dealt with. That's why I get to the door and let it go. I touch the doorknob's hot. So I'm like a kid with a burning stove. You touch it, you realize it's hot. And I just don't like going there anymore, you know? But I'll always say the things that made me, and I hate saying this, but the things that, I'm trying to say it in a humble way, but the things that made me a bad motherfucker on the football field made me sometimes a bad person off the field, or not a bad person, but a bad person to deal with in certain situations, or a bad person mentally because I was so nasty and driven and focused on one singular thing. So I tapped into it for years to play and be really good. I try to tap into it now for life lessons and to not take me back to those bad things.
But it's such a mind fuck, right? To have so much of your identity get rewarded because you were a monster and you needed some of those things to build the confidence that made you stop being the guy who was bullied through fourth grade. All of the stuff that you're talking about that made you great, I could see how. I mean, you do amazing foundation work. You as a father attempt to be super, super present in the lives of your kids. But of course, some of the things that make you who you are as a Hall of Fame football player, they're not functional life skills on if you're never exploring, like, what damage did it do that my dad wasn't actually around? And what patterns am I recreating from the things that I saw that passed for love in my household?
Listen, I have a thing. I want to be everything that my biological father wasn't. I will be everything that he wasn't to my kids. I don't want to be anything that he was. I don't want to be anything that my stepdad was to me. So I know I'm not getting to your point, but I use all those bad things. Put it this way. If you're bullied, abused, looked down on, spit upon, called bad racist names, discriminated against, all the negative things that could happen in anybody's life that I experienced as well, you can overcome all those things. Because if I overcame them, you can too. Or anybody else out there that's listening or watching can too. Because it's all about mindset. I know sometimes people's minds get more messed up than others when people go through different kind of adversity, and it's hard to get through that because maybe they don't have mentors, they don't have the mental makeup to get through it, they don't have any positivity or any foresight. You know, maybe it's no fault of their own, but those things don't define you. Those things don't bury you. You can overcome them all, but it's going to take a lot of work. And sometimes you just got to fucking step on toes and kick down doors and whoop people's asses.
And how do you get to the place that you are Jason Taylor Foundation moved to? I want to teach people to support their artistic side. I want people to know how to read. Why is this stuff important to you in a way that makes you pour this amount of time into it? Beyond, you've told the story, Dan Marino opened a children's hospital. You saw it from one of your mentors, but I've seen some of your work in this community. It's intensely personal for you.
Yeah, number one, because there's a need there, and there was a need, I don't know how old am I now, there was a need 40 years ago for a young mixed kid in Pittsburgh that was dealing with, you know, all the things we talked about, whether it be, you know, the discrimination, the racist stuff, the being looked down upon, living in an area that was where you felt like those concrete walls were the end of your world. Like you couldn't get outside of that, you know, dealing with, you know, 40 years ago, it wasn't, you know, very popular. I guess it was popular. I don't know the right word, but it wasn't very accepted, you know, to be mixed with black and white in certain areas of the world, and particularly in the place that I grew up in Pittsburgh, and you know, hearing a name calling and all those kind of things, there was a need for a kid 40 years ago named Jason Gibson at the time to get help, to have somebody show love, to help have somebody support it, to have somebody say, don't worry about that. That person's ignorant for this, that reason or the other. you can go somewhere else. And that was, so having that need as a kid and understanding I was now in a position when I got in the NFL to provide that for somebody else, that was the catalyst of it. But then as we start to morph from, you know, an education-based foundation that really focused on after school reading and mentorship and all that, we still do that. But then the spoken word poetry came in, and that's what you, for adults, that's what some adults pay for to sit down and speak to a therapist. That's the same thing these kids are getting with the spoken word poetry. They're not reading Shakespeare or Maya Angelou or anything else off a sheet of paper. They're sitting down and writing. Well, most kids nowadays are using their phone, but they're sitting down and they're spilling their heart and their soul into their work and then standing up in front of complete strangers and spitting it out. And when we started doing that, you're like, holy cow, some of these kids are going, like they go way past where I'm going with you right now. You know, they're opening up that door. They're opening up Pandora's box and letting out things that you had no idea. And it could be the happiest, jolliest kid in the world, and they're always smiling and they're this and that. Then they spew into a microphone about the abuse, the sexual assault, the bullying, the things that they see and deal with on a daily basis in their lives. And that was therapeutic for them. And then in a weird way, it was therapeutic for myself and us adults as well. So that's why so much of our foundation has kind of morphed into our poetry network is so big now, what we do, because it's what adults need and we pay for and sometimes aren't vulnerable enough to get help. These kids, we're giving them a free platform to do it. We're bringing out the artistic side of them. They're being celebrated for it. They're growing for it. They're getting more confidence. They're overcoming some of the shit that they had to deal with. And they learned that it's not okay for someone to do that to you. It's not okay to be in that situation. It is also not your fault. And then we're empowering them to move on forward and turn that page or close that door to their past and be able to move on.
JasonTaylorFoundation.com is where you should go if you want more information, because the work is very hands-on in the community, and he really is interested in helping young people maybe have some things that he didn't have. I noticed some hesitance from you. Perhaps I got this wrong, picked it up wrong. I have found that therapy in general is just wonderful. I've never understood the stigma. To give you the tools to better understand yourself, that there's no shame in being able to, hey, can I get some tools so that I can get to work on all the stuff in my past that I might not have known was dysfunctional or blind? You said I've done a lot of work. I did not know what that meant. I can't imagine you being very good at asking for help, though.
No, I don't like asking for help. But pride cometh before the fall sometimes, man. It's sometimes you need it. You know, when you're... You know, and you can make light of it. And you know, when you're 1 in 15, you need a lot of help. You need a lot of help. You need help under center. You need help in the backfield. You need help covering. You need help on the football field. You also need help dealing with it sometimes. You know, and I've gotten help. I've had in-house help with the Dolphins. And sometimes you just got to sit down with a psychiatrist, psychologist, a counselor, your player development person. So I've had long talks with John Gamble. I've had long talks with Caleb Thornhill, who's still at the Dolphins. I've had talks with guys that I looked up to as coaches, and you just pull them aside, whether it be, Dan Quinn, who I reached out to Dan last night again just to chat. But guys like Dan Quinn as your coach, you're dealing with something that you're having a hard time with. I've gotten outside help with a therapist and a counselor, and doesn't do you any good if you're not willing to be vulnerable. And that was the biggest thing that I learned was like, I'd sit and talk to her and, it'd be an hour session, 2.5-3 hours later, she's like, okay, we just talked about a lot of shit, but we didn't talk about anything real. Like when you have to open up, and it took time for me to start to open up and peel those layers back and expose, be vulnerable to her. And it helps. There's nothing wrong with getting help, folks. I mean, there really isn't. And a mental health thing is so, it's come to the forefront now. People are starting to understand it. And I think that the negative stigma surrounding it is kind of going away. I look at someone like Brandon Marshall and the great work he does with trying to give a platform and raise awareness to it. There's nothing wrong with it. Yeah, I went through it. I went through it for professional reasons. I went through it for personal reasons. I went through it to stay sane through football sometimes because it's hard sometimes to relate to other guys whose motivation isn't the same as yours. It's hard to relate sometimes to people accepting failure as, oh, well, we lost this one. We'll be back next week. We're still getting paid. Like, that was really hard for me. That drove me crazy. And you know, I remember sitting with Coach Saban at the times in his office and like, I can't fucking do this. I'm seriously about to put my hands around somebody's throat downstairs because this is the attitude. You know, how can you lose a game and leave the locker room in 10 minutes? You're leaving the locker room before the media even gets in here. First of all, they don't want to talk to your sorry ass, but how are you over it that fast? If you're gone in 10 minutes and then you're late to work the next day for meetings because your ass was on the beach all night. Like, how is that okay? How do you accept just getting your fucking ass kicked on national TV? And, oh, next week, we'll be back next week. I'm still getting paid. Like, I had a really hard time with that.
Who cared as much as you did? Because you cared too much, and I know that it's part of why it is you were great, but who did you look at and say, that guy cares as much as I do? Because my lasting image of you, for all the greatness, Jason, is walking into the locker room again and again, and you were more broken, mentally broken on those losses than anyone. Just hissing, a radiator hissing at your locker of sadness, anger, rage, all of it. It's like, it's your era of Dolphin football. That excellence wasted, that caring wasted. If what we're looking at is Super Bowl victories is the title, or even playoff victories, or the things that you were chasing.
You know, who cared? There was a lot of guys. I mean, there was guys that cared.
No, like you, crazy cared getting mad at teammates because Darryl Gardner doesn't care as much as you, because it's 1-15 and three guys are dropping out because they don't want to play that weekend, because for what, for who?
Zach Thomas, for sure. Zach Thomas, you know, is the number one that it mattered a lot to him. It mattered a lot. And there are probably others. I think on that extreme level, I'd have to say Zach was the one name.
Not that many, Jason. I'm not talking about bragging here. You're matter of fact about these things, but I haven't met a lot that cared the way you did. I have not.
And you're right. There wasn't many guys, and it didn't need to be extreme. It didn't need to be psycho extreme. Like, dude, chill out. It's over. It's an hour. The game's been over for an hour and a half. Take your pads off and relax. Stop breaking stuff. Like, it didn't need to be to that point. So we had guys that cared. We had some guys that didn't give a shit, that it acted, seemed like, but there was one or two of us that it really mattered to. And that was, you know, and Nick Saban helped me a lot. You know, I know people down here, Nick Saban is, you know, very frowned upon and he's a great leader.
He's a great leader. You were defensive player of the year with him, and it easy for you though, Jason. You cared the way he did. Like, of course he was good to you. I mean, he was still telling you to tie your your sneakers during walkthrough, and you didn't have much use for that. But that dude cared in the obsessive compulsive way about excellence that you did.
Yes, and so we were one and the same. Like, we were, you know, people call him an asshole, or he was an asshole. He was my asshole. I loved him, and we saw eye to eye in so many ways. And to this day, I still love him to death. I actually spoke to him last night. We talked on the phone last night, and he's one of the things he told me is, and it sounds so simple, and I have it written down still. And I think, matter of fact, it's in my car. Mediocre people don't like high achievers, and high achievers cannot freaking stand mediocre people. So it's just, he's like, you're not going to get along with this guy because you guys don't see it the same way. You're a high achiever. He's almost mediocre, but was below mediocre. Like, you could try to bring him along with you. He's like, but you pushing him isn't going to do it. Sometimes you just got to tell him, hit your wagon to the back of me and I'll take you as far as I can. But at some point he's going to fall off because he can't go that high. So that was the big, and that kind of put it in perspective a little bit for me and helped me out a little bit, but it's so true, man. Mediocre people cannot stand high achievers, and high achievers freaking hate mediocre people.
You mentioned vulnerability. Do you know what it is or where it is or how it is that you realized, oh, wait a minute, me being vulnerable with others is actually something I need to be doing. I'm not going to have meaningful relationships or connection points if I don't show people beyond the camouflage and show them like the real stuff that I don't want to show anybody.
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember exactly when it was, but as you get older and as I got later in my career, you know, sometimes you're so worried about saying something off color, not off color, but you're saying something in an interview that isn't the coach speak, or you don't want to say anything. Before podcasts were big, now we kind of can sit down and be comfortable. You're always wanting to say the company line and move on the next week and all this stuff that I used to hear you always say on the radio, how you couldn't stand, oh, here comes the coach speak. You're kind of taught that in a way. The culture kind of pushes you in a way to say that. So I've always felt like that was the way it had to be. You can't really step outside the box. You can't really say what you want. And I abided by that until I got to the boiling point after a loss. And then sometimes I would dispute. I would just blow up. Or in a locker room, I would be myself and blow up. But you get such superficial relationships with people when your football career or your greatness in your sport is the main catalyst of your friendship or dominates the conversation at dinner or dominates the conversation at an event. Like, yeah, okay, you were a great football player. Tell me about when you played the Cowboys or you played the Buffalo Bills. And like, you can only go so far with that. And then those friendships, players don't want to be around someone that constantly talks football all the time. You want something bigger. Let's talk about business. Let's talk about politics. Let's talk about everything that people say you shouldn't talk about, politics or religion, anything besides just freaking football, And you realize that if you're not willing to peel back and really show who you truly are to the closest ones to you, then you hit that wall and you just there's no real meaningful relationship there. So as you start to go outside the box, talk about your upbringing a little bit, or you talk about something besides football, and you drop an F-bomb every once in a while in a conversation. And even you do it, I do it in events sometimes. I'll be speaking, sometimes having a little levity, being self-deprecating and being real goes so far. And I see it so much now when in coaching, it's kids see through that stuff. The coach speak, the being the fake, trying to put on a persona, people see through that. Players see through that, and pro players see through it. Be real. And if not everybody's Nick Saban, not everyone's Bill Belichick. But don't try to be that. If that's not you, just be real. I just think it's so much more endearing, and I think you get guys to really love you and appreciate you for who you are, and then it's so much more fulfilling.
Any place along your career where you wish you had spoken more freely and not towed the company line?
Probably. I can't. Maybe when I was in Washington, I probably should have spoken up more. I was new. I got traded there and felt like, even though you're an established veteran and have a big resume, you're new to an area, so you feel like you should take a little bit of back. So you probably should have spoke up more there. So that's one thing that comes to mind for sure. I did a bit more at the Jets, even though we didn't need it. We had a very outspoken coach that I thought did a really good job in a strong locker room. But, my first, and really it was until Nick Saban got here. And I did a little bit when Coach Monstat was, when Dave was the coach, but not as much as I should. And that was one of the things that Coach Saban challenged me early on in 2005 when he first got here. He's like, look, if you're going to be a leader, you can't be everybody's best friend. Sometimes you've got to step on toes. Sometimes you've got to jump somebody's ass. Sometimes you've got to put your arm around the guy that everyone doesn't want on the team and bring him a little closer and help him out too. So it's not always just being an asshole. Sometimes it's taking care of somebody and cuddling somebody sometimes and nurturing them sometimes. But he's like, you got to stop being afraid to step on toes. And, because you want to be liked, you want your teammates to respect you and love you and all. JT's a great teammate and all that. But again, that only goes so far if you're not real. When Coach Saban kind of unleashed, I guess, the beast in me sometimes, I was never afraid from that point on to step on somebody's toes if they weren't doing what they needed to do.
Can you give me a good one? I know you're probably not going to give me a name, but give me a good one that you remember of like, well, that felt good. I was a leader and I really got up into somebody. I lit somebody up and it felt good.
Dude, you're an ass. You're an asshole.
Come on, man. Like, I'd prefer it. If you'd give me the name, that'd be even better. But you always give me the honest stuff, man. And now there are no consequences. Like, you have been very good about articulating to this audience what this world is like, because I don't think they understand it. And I don't think that we have any access to how it is that you are, what it takes to be as good as what you were. And so I flattered you enough. Give me the story.
All right, I'll give I'm going to give you a name.
No consequences outside of your own personal relationships, which I may destroy. But I'm trying to give this all the context. Yeah, exactly. I'm badgering him for the story, and he doesn't want to tell it. He's telling it reluctantly of Jason Taylor learning how to be a leader because it was just required by Nick Saban so that he could grow as a Hall of Fame football player.
There was just things that needed to be said, and it can't always come from the head coach. And sometimes, and again, I don't want people to think that I was a total dickhead out there and yelling at everybody, because that wasn't the case. I was a great teammate, fun, happy. As long as we worked hard and we did our job, I was all about having fun. But sometimes shit had to be said. So let me get in front of my chair here. 2005, we're playing. We were not very good. Nick Saban was the first year here, his first year here. We're playing the Cleveland Browns up in Cleveland. Zach Thomas ended up getting hurt that game, and they weren't very good. We weren't very good either. But so we're playing up there, second or third quarter. I think it was third quarter. We had a rookie named Matt Roth. Great, great guy. I didn't really understand the defense yet. Was still learning.
Crazy meathead.
Oh, big time from Iowa. Yeah, he'll run through a brick wall if you tell him. He'll run straight through a brick wall. But if he had to make a right or a left, you're gonna have to put breadcrumbs down. So we're staying there during a TV timeout in the field. Matt's coming in the game. Jogging from the sideline, and I'm like, I pointed back to the sideline. I was like, get the fuck. What are you? You're not. Get out of here. You're not playing. He's like, no. Coach sent me in. I'm like, get your ass out of the game. And, you know, Matt's a rookie, so he stops, he turns and jogs back. And Dan Quinn was our D-line coach. So Dan Quinn, I could see Dan, tell him to go back. And Matt Roth, he's between the numbers and the sideline. He's just, going back and forth during a TV timeout. Dan's telling him to go back. I'm telling him to get the fuck off the field. Finally, he comes in the huddle. I was like, what are you doing? He's like, coach keeps sending me in here because this player took himself out. And I'm like, whatever. So they're about to break the huddle. I'm like, you better not fuck this up. So we go through the series, go to the sideline, and this player's on the sideline. And I'm like, dude, what's up with you? You hurt? He's like, he gave me some BS. And I'm like, the fuck are you doing? Like, we were still in the game. It was 13-0. We still in the game. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, okay, whatever. I go sit down. Fourth quarter. He's still not in the game. So TV timeout. Matt Roth runs his happy ass back on the field. And I'm like, hold on. So we got a TV timeout. So I walk in the sideline, and Dan Quinn sees me coming, and Dan's like, giving me this. And this is before the blue tents and all that. Like, if you're hurt, you should be getting attended to, or you get your ass back in the game. So I go over to the player on the sideline, and I'm yelling from the sideline. He's really big, so I didn't want to get too close to him. I'm just giving it to him. Like, what the? And I'll give you the name later, and trust me. Maybe. I'm yelling. I go back on the field. Anyway, we lose the game. So we go in the locker room after the game. We lose 20-0. I think I shut out. We go in the locker room. And Coach Saban had this thing where he'd come in, he'd tell everyone to take a knee. He wanted everybody on the knee. He had that. That was like the college thing of him. Because most times in the NFL, guys are standing or whatever when the coach is talking. He says, bring it up, take a knee. Everyone takes a knee. And he had yelled at somebody in weeks past about not taking a knee. I wasn't taking a knee. I was in the back, and I'm steaming. I'm just like pacing behind the circle of guys, or the semicircle of guys that are around coach. The coach does his thing, talks. He was never real long, talked for a minute or two. And he's never done this, but I was steaming in the back, and he goes, anybody else got anything? Well, he knew I had something. He knew that I wanted to blow up. Anybody else got something? So there was a helmet on the ground. I take the helmet and I just fire it into this Gatorade machine. There was a Gatorade cooler by the train before the showers were on this side, the training rooms on this side. There was a Gatorade cooler. I just fire this helmet into the Gatorade machine, just shatter the glass, and there's shit all over the ground. And as I'm starting to walk around the back of the group to go up front, because I had something to say, I was going to just let it go. Because sometimes I let it build up and then I just explode. So I'm trying to walk around the group. There's like this much room. I'm still in my pads and everything. There's like this much room between the back of the group of guys and this table that had like the wheel call tickets, the bubble gum, all the little shit. And then this big ass bun, I think that's how you say it, bun coffee maker, like the big coffee maker. So as I'm going, table's not really in my way, but fuck it. I'm already balls deep in it. I might as well. I just take the table and I freaking flip the table. Coffee machine flies. The little beaker of coffee breaks and it shatters and splashes all over the back of Matt Roth because he's in the back because the rookies are in the back. So it's like burning Matt's back, but he's afraid to yell out anything because I'm going off. So I just start screaming about guys quitting on us. And if you don't want to fucking be here, I'm going on and on and on for about 5 minutes. And I was like, if you don't want to fucking be here, we'll give you a ride home tonight. You can get on the plane. We'll give you a ride back to Miami. But when we get back, just fucking leave and I'll pay your salary the rest of the season. I'll just pay your fucking salary. I'd rather you not be here. So we get done. I do the thing that you've seen for so many years. I'm sitting in my locker forever. I do the media. I think Harvey and the guys kept me away for a little while. And then they finally let me do the media. So it's time for me to get a shower. I go in the shower. There's a few young guys still in the shower, like two or three. And I felt like Debo from Friday for a second. So I walk in, like they see me come in, like they grab their shit and leave. Like they still got soap on them. They're like, they walk out. I'm like, hey, you got soap on your back. And they're like, oh, I'm all right. They just walk out.
Is it just your rage or is it also who you're challenging specifically? Because there were a couple of guys to be feared, even if they might have not had quite your mental spirit.
Yeah, I think it was the rage. And then I think most people knew who I was talking about because I didn't name the name when I was going off, but I was staring a hole through them. So it was the rage. And I'm not Tim Bowens or Daryl Gardner where I'm physically imposing, but they're like, JT's on one. Stay the hell away because I don't want him hitting me with a coffee machine or Gatorade or whatever. So I go in, when we get done, I get dressed, I go into the equipment room. So Joey and Charlie and those guys are in there still packing up, getting ready to load the buses up. And they used to always have leftovers from halftime, whether it be hot dogs and shit, whatever. So I'm in there, I'm getting a hot dog. So Zach's in there. Zach, I think, is on crutches because he got hurt that game. And that was part of me going off. I was so pissed off and Zach was hurt. He's in there trying to play. We got guys fucking quitting. So I'm getting a hot dog. I remember I got a hot dog and I take the foil off the freaking Cleveland hot dog. It was probably made 12 years ago. And I'm putting ketchup on it. And I'm standing there with Zach, who's on crutches. Charlie Field was in there. Joey Tomino and Bonnie Holiday was there. So I'm bitching to Bonnie. I'm like, can you believe that so-and-so did that? And as I'm doing it, Bonnie's giving me a look like, chill. And I didn't realize this person was walking up behind me. So he walks up behind me, gets a hot dog, and he was like, JT, I'm so glad you said that shit. He's like, it needed to be said. These guys got to stop. And Bonnie Holiday bear hugs me and picks me up and carries me. He's like, just go. Bonnie took me out of the equipment room, into the hallway, got my bag and made me leave, walked me to the bus. So we get to the airplane. As soon as we take off, I'm up in the front galley. I got a drink. I'm up in the front galley and I'm still steaming. Channing Crowder walks up and he was like, hey, JT, I know you had a moment there. Channing's a rookie at the time, by the way. Channing's like, hey, I know you had a moment there. I don't mean any disrespect. He's like, I look up to you. Like you're my dog. I just wanted to clarify real quick. He's like, and don't take this the wrong way, but he's like, were you serious about, like, if when we get back, if we quit, are you serious about paying the rest of our salary?
He was negotiating.
Yeah. So I was like, Channing, this ain't the time, Channing. Channing, just go sit down. This ain't the time. And then 2 minutes later, Kevin Carter walks up front. And he was like, hey, I know you were talking to me. I'm sorry. I apologize. I was just, my back was hurt, whatever it was hurting. He's like, would you say what needed to be said? He was like, I really thought you were going to call me out in front of everybody, but I appreciate you not doing it. I'm like, KC, everyone knows who it was. And he was like, it'll never happen again. And then we went on to win six straight. And it's not, we didn't win six straight because of that, but we needed to get that shit out.
That is a pretty cool story though, because I'm sure he respected it. This is a guy who led the league in sacks 1 year, right? He got there so that when you're doing that, you're one of the few people who could actually see whether he was trying or not, because you knew how good he could be at the top end of what he did.
Right. And it was a moment and it was good. I mean, I remember Jason Garrett came to me at the end of the season. Jason Garrett was on the staff, before he went to Dallas, became the head coach. And he was like, That's one of the greatest things I've ever seen in the locker room. And we absolutely needed that in our team. He's like, you weren't even talking to an offensive player. He's like, but there was three or four offensive players I could have given you the name that they were doing the same thing. And we absolutely needed to have it. So that was one of the bad ones.
We're going to let you go on that note, but I want to clean up a handful of things here with you at the very end. I had a catheter in your arm accidentally, and Mike Ryan said it's a pick line, not a catheter, although I can imagine Jason Taylor playing with a catheter in his armpit, in his penis, everywhere.
You had him playing with a catheter in his dickhole.
Yeah, I did.
Next time we do this, we'll talk about the pick line in my heart. Yeah.
Yeah, just crazy. Also, that coaching staff was crazy, right? You've got this coaching staff. Kirby Smart was on that coaching staff too, right?
Yeah, Nick Saban, Kirby Smart, Will Muschamp, Dan Quinn, Dom Capers. I mean, we had a squad.
And I want the title of this episode to be Jason Taylor and then a colon, Nick Saban was my asshole, is what I want. But I just want that to get aggregated, people to be confused by it. I just, I always...
That's going
to
be weird.
I always say this genuinely, Jason. It's been true, I think, since the first time that I talked to you, and certainly pretty close. I always enjoy the time. It is a pleasure. I don't say that flippantly. It is always a pleasure that you allow us access to the dark and rage-filled mind that produced such excellence for the Miami Dolphins over so many years. Thank you for showing us that side of yourself.
Anytime. I always enjoy talking to you, and you know what? I love the conversations we have because you always dig deep. You have a way of unpeeling layers. But I do have to clear up one thing because I was listening to your podcast actually this morning on the way to the golf course. I'm with you. And David Sampson is freaking out of his mind. A coach should never put his fucking hands on a player. Ever. I don't care what. I was in the car steaming. I was acting like you were on the radio live, like I wanted to call in. But I'm like, how are you justifying what Bruce Arians did? Now, I get you don't want to get in a fight and get a flag or whatever. Teammates can grab each other, but that wasn't a good, that was a hit. David Sampson, come here. You stand in front of me. I'm going to do what Bruce Arians did to him, and you tell me if I just hit you or if it was a love tap. My ass. Bring your – I respect David Sampson, but next time I see him, I'm going to be like – when I walk up, I'm not going to shake his hand. I'm going to do that across his head. Be like, oh, I didn't hit you. I was just saying hello.
Well, I don't. It's the disrespect that bothers you the most, right? Like, it's just that, like, it's just it, that I've always been offended by the idea that someone like you would need something like that. That's not coaching. That's not helpful.
No, and like you said, if he turns around and the heat, and you, Bruce Arians can't say it's the heat of the moment. Listen, I love Bruce Arians. I think he's a great coach and great dude. But oh wait, I just did it in the heat of the moment. Well, what happens if that player turns around in the heat of the moment and puts your ass to sleep? Then he's probably going to be in Antonio Brown's music video next week over there with him out of the league. Like, no, that's wrong.
I didn't even ask you about Antonio Brown because your prism, I'd be fascinated as a professional, right? You were always a pillar of professionalism. You didn't have any bad. Did you have any bad public moments? Maybe going back and forth with Parcells is the worst of it, and Parcells wronged you. But I can't even imagine how you experienced watching Antonio Brown doing all of that, making a fool of himself at the end of or in the middle of a game.
Yeah, we'll dive into that if we ever do this again.
All right.
Because I could take on another 15 minutes, and we'll do a Parcells episode and a Cam Cameron episode. And
all right. I'm going to welcome you back for all of that. See you later. See you later.
All right. Go Tigers.
Our thanks to Jason Taylor, and a reminder to support all of the things on the Lebatard and Friends Network. If you want this stuff to keep coming to you, we don't expect you to listen to all of it, but we do want to provide a number of different options for you. So you've got Bob Weir from The Grateful Dead on Stupidity. He calls it a thrill of a lifetime. I encourage you to check that out. Amin El Hassan is doing a lot of work on Mystery Crate about the Star Wars Boba Fett series. And if you're interested in Star Wars, I suggest that you check that out. Thank you for supporting this. And thank you for supporting Montgomery & Company, for supporting Off the Looking Glass, for supporting the podcast with Mike Shore and Joe Posnanski. Please, Lebatard and Friends Network, support the people who support us.
My team is one win away, and I'll tell you exactly what I'm going to do to celebrate once they get past this series. I'm going to go to my fridge, and I'm going to get myself an ice-cold can of Miller Lite. A lot's changed over the years, but one thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and it still hasn't been settled. You see, Miller Lite keeps it simple. Undebatable quality, great taste, and only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything that you don't need and holds on to what matters most. A light beer that tastes like beer, less filling and only 96 calories. The original light beer since 1975. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right at your door, visit MillerLite.com/beach, B-E-A-C-H. Or you can get it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.